Blog Talk Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, performer, musician, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone. I'm very happy to have joining me today Rob Roberge. How are you, Rob?
Doing well. How you doing, Rich?
Doing well. You know, when introducing you, I was going to say writer Rob Roberge, but in all fairness, you are really so much more than that. And for the listeners out there not familiar with Rob, let me tell you a little about him. Besides being a compelling novelist and short story writer, Rob Roberge is also an award-winning teacher. He's currently core faculty at UCR Palm Desert's MFA program. He's taught at Antioch, UCLA. He's volunteered at 826 LA, Jail Guitar Doors. He plays guitar and sings with the LA bands, the Danbury Shakes, the Violet Rays, and the Urinals. His writing's been featured in The Rumpus, The Nervous Breakdown, Zizova, and other publications. Rob's fourth book, the novel The Cost of Living, is currently out on Other Voices Books. Rob, I was hoping you could start out by telling us about The Cost of Living.
It takes place over 30 years in the life of a guy who becomes an indie rock guitar player and battles a lifelong problem with addiction and his mother's suicide and his sort of disenfranchised relationship with his father throughout the course of the book.
It's been said that The Cost of Living, which is about a junkie musician, is your most autobiographical one to date. I also know that you've been posting nonfiction to The Rumpus and The Nervous Breakdown about an ex-junkie musician, and I'm curious, what are you able to express through one form versus the other, and what are your thoughts on the overlap and differences between autobiographical fiction and nonfiction?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially these days, I think. It's tricky. In fiction, Richard Yates used to say, the facts aren't necessarily true, but the emotions are, whereas in nonfiction, the events or the facts should be true, but then it calls into debate what's true. I could have the same event from my point of view versus my sister's versus my father's, and all three would be radically different stories.
Kind of the Rashomon effect.
Yeah, exactly. Nabokov said, memory is a revision. So the further along you get in telling a story and the more you tell it, I think maybe the closer you get to the truth, the furthest you get from the fact, in a way.
Sort of an emotional truth versus sort of that kind of realistic truth to some degree?
Yeah, I think so. Hopefully you don't just willy-nilly lie, but
sure, of course,
which is what fiction is good for. It's weird though. I think we're in a strange period where, in some ways, like the effects of reality TV have trickled into literature, and there's been this fetishization of fact an event where people are just obsessed with whether or not something happened, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. That's a question that increasingly I get asked, did that really happen?
Right. Sometimes you're referred to as an edgy, shocking writer because sex, violence, drug use, and crime often inhabit your work. And while some writers might employ these devices as a way to titillate their readers, I'm pretty sure you use them as genuine tools of characterization and to reveal deeper issues. Can you talk about that?
Well, thanks. I mean, I hope I do. You know, I mean, something that just sort of titillates a reader there to shock, you know, I would hope I'm not doing that. You know, that's an easy thing to do. And although maybe increasingly difficult thing to shock a reader, you know, like Elvis right. wiggled his hips in 1956 and that was enough to get you banned. I mean, God knows what you'd have to do to get banned now. I actually had an idea to get banned for this book. I was going to like open up a bunch of different email accounts and like send really misspelled emails and texts to every Christian radio and Fox News outlet I could and say this disgusting person teaches for the University of California. He's on the taxpayer dollar and see if I could get myself banned that way. But it just took too much effort, you know. but yeah, I mean, it's all, I would hope, at the service of character and revealing, you know, people's needs and desires. And, you know, to me, interesting fiction is largely, I mean, life is, people are interesting to see what they'll do to get what they want. You know, and if you don't have a character in fiction under some sort of enormous pressure, chances are they're not going to be that interesting. And,
right.
You know, and some of this stuff just inhabited a lot of years of my life. And generally, you know, some of the years that followed that were better have perhaps less narrative interest. You know, life is good. It's hard to tell it, you know. 15-page chapter about life being good. a weird reciprocal
People
law.
People don't want
know?
To hear like, when things are going well for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's like a Margaret Atwood piece, I think it's called Happy Marriage or something, about these two people that meet in their 20s, their politics and sexuality are very compatible, and they have two wonderful children, satisfying jobs, and they die in their sleep together when they're 82 years old. And she's like, that's a wonderful life. It's a terrible story. You know, so there's sort of an inverse law of narrative, I think.
Right. You know, one of the executive editors of Other Voices Books, which has published your latest novel, someone we both love and admire, Gina Frangello, I once read that your experience working with her as an editor has been one of your best. What made that possible?
Oh, it was by far the best experience I've ever had with an editor. I mean, and it was, you say what made that possible?
Yeah, what made that possible that you've had such a great experience with Gina versus other editors you've worked with?
Well, I've been lucky with editors, actually. I haven't had any horror stories, but with Gina, it was just on another level. I mean, the only thing I probably would have been worried about going into it was that we were close friends prior to it. And, you know, I didn't want to put her in an awkward position of, you know, privileging the friendship over an editorial note. And I should not have to worry about that.
Right.
She was actually great. She was enormously intimate with what I do well and what I don't do well. And she pushed me in the weak spots, just as a good editor should, and really, you know, understood the work in both a similar and different way to me, and both of those were conducive to getting better revisions out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I mean, publishing fiction, especially novel length, like a sustained work, is far more collaborative, I think, than the average reader would guess. You know, there's the notion that the writer just does it all themselves, and if anything, I think it's one of the only dangers to a sort of culture of self-publishing is that you'll lose the governor that a great editor puts on a piece of work and
right.
that someone who pushes you to do your best work. Like, you know, I've been at this, 25, 27 years. And if I were to just put a book out on my own without, someone who had a stake in putting their name on it as well, and an investment in pushing me to get past, you know, things I don't do well, it wouldn't be nearly as good a book, you know?
Sure.
And,
have you heard of any particular horror stories or anything where an editor, rather than helping to serve a piece of work, harmed it in some way, or just was a nightmare of a process?
I've heard some horror stories, both ways on that, and like a third way where, which I think this may be the worst in some ways, although not as difficult as working with someone who you think is unintentionally damaging the work. I mean, I don't think anyone sets out to do that, but possibly the worst, even if it's not as bad a process, is I've had friends whose books were acquired by editors who were then fired or who quit, and then your book gets sort of washed ashore onto some other editor's desk, and they didn't acquire it, and they have, even if they liked the book, and chances are they haven't read it with a tremendous focus because they didn't acquire it. So if it's a success, it's someone else's success, and if it's a failure, it's theirs. So
Yeah.
they pretty much tend to not do anything with those books. So that's a a roll of the die as far as major publishing goes. They
Yeah,
tend not to happen.
as I'm sure
I'm
you've
sorry.
heard, I've also heard similar stories like that in the music industry as well.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, even when there's more money at stake, there are worse stories. I mean, the
Yeah.
music industry is just full of them.
Yeah. Sometimes writers talk about getting stuck, either not being able to come up with an idea or not being able to get out of their own way and letting their writing speak for itself. What do you think that's all about, and how do you go about dealing with those issues in your own writing?
I mean, for me, it's usually that I'm not getting out of the way of the process enough, that I'm trying to go sort of lead it rather than follow it. There's a great William Gass quote where he said, every line offers opportunity and obstacle. And if you're stuck, it's because you're not reading the line you just wrote. You're thinking about the next one. So they sort of come out of each other if you pay close attention. And generally, if you've reached a dead end, I mean, the metaphor of the dead end is that your mistake is not where you are, it's a turn you made somewhere before. So you have to backtrack and get back out onto the main road and not make that turn,
Right.
So, I mean, my reaction to it is usually, self-loathing and doubt. But that's my reaction to a lot of things. So I'm used to that. But yeah, just trying to go back to where it was working is usually my technique, is the last
Right.
place where I thought it was really clicking and singing, and then go from there and throw out what got me to the dead end.
Writers sometimes talk about writer's block. What do you think is involved with that?
I really I
And have you ever, have you ever experienced write quote unquote writer's block, or what does that mean to you?
If you had asked me like 4 or 5 years ago, I would have just said, for me, it's something that's never happened. Like, I've been lazy and I haven't worked, but I haven't ever been blocked. But and I had a period where I actually, I mean, I could write, I just couldn't write well, and I couldn't even, with every project, I think people should be trying to set out to do something they haven't done and something better than what they've done, and I couldn't even write, to the quality of stuff I'd been writing a decade before. So that was maybe an introduction to a form of writer's block. I mean, it's weird. I don't know if you've had this experience, though, Rich. Like, when I'm around other writers, like, we'll end up telling each other stories just sitting around, whether it's a restaurant or a bar or in a room somewhere, and I'll walk out of a space like that realizing that I have more material that I talked about that day than I can get to in the rest of my life.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you're alone, that doesn't always present itself that way. So.
Yeah. Sometimes I conversationally find myself telling a story that sounds better in conversation than I could actually express it on paper.
Yeah, there are some like that, Any that have like voices or accents frustrate the hell out of me to try to get them on the page.
Right.
There are just certain cadences that don't lend themselves to, ink on a page.
Yeah.
But you try to work with that, hopefully.
Sure. There are so many things I love about your latest novel, The Cost of Living, including the fact that you actually created a soundtrack for it, which is available for streaming and downloading, I believe, on your website. How did you come up with the idea for the soundtrack, and who were some of the other musicians involved in the recording process?
I don't know how the idea originated. I think it was just something from Gina and I were having conversations about the book, and I think it just came out of conversations, as far as I can recall, that, you know, oh, it's a fake band, there should be a fake record.
And then
things got really busy, you know, with the various stages of publication, like finishing the book and getting it right. And we had already decided that there was, you know, there was going to be a fake band soundtrack to this. And in the last, three or four months, I was driving my website designer and friend Patrick O'Neill crazy, you know, because he was saying, okay, we've got all this stuff, but we got to get the music page up. And I'm like, oh, I haven't gotten to all that yet.
Right.
And so, you know, it was something that was an idea that probably should have been more of a plan. But we ended up, like, rushing it together. But in the book, it's supposed to be a record of demos and lo-fi outtakes. So I sort of lowered the bar production standard-wise in the narrative so that I wouldn't have to, you know, do a Steely Dan album or something like that.
Right.
So it was allowed to be raw. And some of the musicians were some of my bandmates, well, all of them at various times, from the Danbury Shakes, which is Steve Alfaro, Gail Fornatero, Jeff Amaral, and Elliot Goldkind, who did he also added cello and a production to one tune and a bunch of other instruments. Elliot's a real musician. So I had some really nice people slumming with me. So it was very kind of them.
Nice.
And my buddy Stephen Wilson from Plastic Soul is on a couple cuts. And they're just a fabulous sort of power pop rock band out of L.A.
Excellent.
Yeah, just about everyone sounds better when they're not playing with me. Everyone is involved with this.
Well, I actually want to play a song from the soundtrack called Breakup Sex, which I think just rocks. It's
thanks.
Quite
Steven's
wonderful.
Steven's on guitar on that one.
Oh, excellent. All right, let's go ahead and play it. Breakup Sex from the soundtrack to The Cost of Living. Or at least I think we're going to play it. That was Breakup Sex by Rob Roberge and the boys. From the soundtrack, the novel, The Cost of Living. That was wonderful, Rob.
No, thanks. And actually, Carlos Santos on drums on that one. Sorry, I should give credit. Yeah, he's a fabulous drummer.
You know, one of the cool things about that song, one that really piqued my interest and wanted to play it on the show, it has a little bit of a feel that it could have almost been off the Lou Reed Transformer record or something.
Yeah, that's probably one of my main rip-off sources.
Well, you know, we all have our rip-off sources. That's definitely a good one to have. I want to sort of take a pause in all the questions to mention that you are going to be actually doing a reading here in LA next week, Thursday, April 18th, at Molly Malone's in Hollywood as part of the Brad Listy's Nervous Breakdown Literary Experience. You're going to be reading from the novel, also playing with your band, well, in the urinals. And other readers are going to include Jillian Lauren. It's such a great bill. Jillian Lauren, Lenore Zion, Emily Rapp. I'll be doing a poem. And I believe you're also going to be on a panel next Sunday here in LA at the Festival for Books. Can you talk a little about that?
And Thursday is, I think, going to be really fun. I'm glad
Thursday's
you're
be
there,
great.
Too. Yeah, it's a great lineup. Sunday is at the Festival of Books at 2:00. I'm on a panel called True Grit. They always come up with these titles for the panels. with Jim Ruland from Vermin on the Mount is moderating, and my friend Josh Moore is on the panel, and Jim Greer, and I'm not sure, a couple other people who I should have made a note of. I feel bad not knowing it all off the top of my head, but that says more about me than them. It should be a really cool panel, and it's, I believe it's 2:00, Conversation 2113 in the Annenberg Building or Palladium or whatever.
Nice.
Yeah, it should be fun.
Do you have any, so you're doing the event on Thursday, the Nervous Breakdown at Molly Malone's, you're going to be on the panel Sunday for the Festival of Books. Do you have any other LA appearances? Because I know you're going to be touring the book soon. Anything else in LA or, you know, San Francisco or anything in the nearby surroundings?
Nothing in LA that I can recall at the top of my head. I know going to Chicago and New York for BEA coming up next month, and then San Francisco definitely going to. We had a date picked out, and it didn't work out for a couple of the people involved, so San Francisco's up in the air right now, but probably sometime in the summer. But no other LA stuff as far as I can recall until, I believe, June 19th. I'm doing another Nervous Breakdown event.
Sweet.
But... I don't know, people will have to check the website for the specifics on that because I think I don't know the location or the lineup for that exactly yet.
Right. You know, I know you have a true reverence for writing as an art form and a craft. And for those people listening who've never had a chance to study with you, can you talk a little about how you've conducted your writing classes and what information you've been able to pass along to your students in the process of helping them to become better writers?
I'm sorry, what was the question there? I'm sorry.
Well, basically, I'm wondering, what have you, you know, because you're an award-winning teacher, people rave about you as a writing teacher, and I'm curious what information you've been able to pass along to your students in the process of helping them to become better writers?
You know, it's weird, Saul Bellow said that a writer is a reader moved to emulation, you know, and I think hopefully a good teacher is a student moved to emulate, you know, their best mentors. And I try to give students, you know, one hopes that something similar to the best of what I got when I was a student. I mean, we're always students of writing, but, you know, it's an extended apprenticeship until you die. But you know, hopefully just give them the attention that my work got that surprised me, how much people cared. The best of my professors and mentors, you know, but also, you know, hope that I can help them lose some of their bad habits more quickly than I did. You know, I think a big thing about studying any craft is getting rid of shitty habits. And I'm sorry, are we on the FCC?
No, we're fine. Right. We're fine. But, you know, actually, this might be a good thing. This could lend to that whole credence of, you know, all the Christians, you know, banning you and creating more promo for the novel.
Yeah, but I didn't want to leave you with a fine, so I can't really pick up the tab.
Well, what, you know, speaking of those bad habits, do you find that there are certain universal bad habits that writers often have?
I see patterns, yeah, in the students I work with. You know, one of the things is, and it makes total sense, is this combination of the sort of influence of the visual medium and insecurity in writing prose, where people won't tell the reader what's going on, and they'll mistake that for being suspenseful. When in fact it's just sort of jerking the reader's chain and they'll hate you and they'll put the book down. Sort of, you know, not, you know, you find out on page 20 that the story is from the point of view of a doorknob. And it's like, you know, and someone thinks that that's going to really make the reader go, oh, wow, it's from the point of view of a doorknob. I was so surprised. When in fact they're just going to be like, you know, screw you. I just wasted 20 pages on you to find out you weren't invested in all except to pull the rug out from under me with a gimmick. You know, and usually, you know, when someone's doing that, it seems, you know, Kervonik has said it seems mean-spirited, but it's really the result of being insecure and not trusting that their story is good enough. So they start throwing gimmicks into it. And, you know, I think, you know, part of helping someone develop their writing and their aesthetic is also pointing out where it's really good. And a lot of times people don't know that just as much as they don't know where it's bad, you know?
Right. What about the idea of when we as writers feel like we have control over our writing? What do you think's involved with that versus those moments where our writing actually surprises us and says what it wants to say as opposed to what we want it to say?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's the trick, I think. You know, we were sort of touching on before with the block and whatnot, because you can write and not be blocked, but not necessarily be writing well. And that's usually, to me, when I feel like I'm in control of it. Like, I usually know if I'm going well. If like if I have two characters talking and one of them makes me laugh, and I didn't see what they were going to say coming, it means I'm inside the character and it surprised me, and it's usually a good sign. You know,
right.
And actually, the teaching thing for people who haven't worked with me, if I haven't scared them off, I'm teaching at Other Voices in Mexico this summer, and that link's on my website. And that's a great program with Pam Houston and Stacey Ryan and Gina Frangel are going to be there, and looks like just a fabulous program, the Other Voices writing program there.
What do you think teaching writing offers you and your own writing?
You know, it's funny. I have to really pay attention to what I say, and make sure that it's still, you know, something I believe. Like, it keeps me in check on my aesthetic. Like, if I, you know, because it's wrong to tell people, you know, a certain thing and then not apply it to your own work. So it keeps me in touch with my own bad habits, my own things to look out for. But, you know, it's also a lot easier to spot issues on other people's manuscripts than it is on your own. Like, my good friend Craig Clevenger did a fabulous reading of this novel and sent me his notes. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is exactly, you know, 20 of these things are things I say on student manuscripts 400 times a week. And here he's finding it in mine, and I missed them entirely.
Right.
So, you know, you know, but hopefully, you know, having to say things over and over, there's a danger of getting overly familiar with them and not letting them have an impact on you because you've just said them so many times.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, going back over like things I've said to people and trying to apply it to my own work is something that I hope helps, you know. But really fighting, you know, after having taught for, 17 years now, creative writing, fighting being overly familiar with the advice and losing touch with it applying to my own work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if one is to accomplish anything from their art, and when I say art, I mean that broadly, writing, music, whether it's the goal of a higher purpose, some type of higher purpose to make a living, get laid, whatever, what would you say?
A valid higher purpose.
Exactly, exactly. What do you feel like you aspire to with your writing and music? I know that's sort of a broad question, might not, you know, not so easy to answer necessarily, but what are some of the things you aspire to?
I think art is like a sort of adult sanctioned space of play, you know, that, and, you know, we tell each other stories and we have, you know, since we could record them. But, you know, to me, it's that excitement, you know, when a kid just, you know, shows up in front of you and says, here, I brought you this. And, you know, it seems like a pretty innocuous thing, but they're just thrilled about it, that there's an infectious desire to share, you know, something that electrifies them. And I think, you know, art is a sophisticated version, or not always sophisticated, of that that childlike desire to say, this means something to me and I want to share it with you. And
right.
Hopefully that excitement, you know, transfers to the audience. You know?
Nice. We're getting close to the end of our time, Rob. Where can people find out more about you, your books, and music online?
I guess all that would be at robroberge.com with all the HTs and Ws in front of it. That has all the info on the books and the older books, too, and the music and stuff.
Nice. I want to remind everyone that, again, next Thursday, April 18th, at Molly Malone's in Hollywood, which is at 575 South Fairfax Ave in lovely Hollywood, Rob will be reading at the Nervous Breakdown Literary Experience along with Jillian Lauren, Lenore Zion, Emily Rapp, and myself. He'll also be on that panel next Sunday at the Festival of Books. I want to send a shout out to our show sponsor, Rare Bird Lit. For all your writerly needs, please visit Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia online at rarebirdlit.com. Rare Bird Lit will also have a booth at the Festival of Books next Sunday. They'll also be co-hosting a big blowout party, a literary extravaganza, there you go, Saturday, April 20th at 7:30 at the Last Bookstore in downtown L.A. That's at 453 South Spring Street. There'll be cocktails, beautiful people, literary types galore, and featured readings by some of my faves, Jerry Stahl, John Albert, Jonathan Gold, Tosh Berman. The list goes on and on. I'll even get a poem or two in there. You can find out more about that at lastbookstorela.com. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. Speaking of which, you can find me, Rich Ferguson, online at wevoicesing.com, Facebook, YouTube. Rob Roberge, thank you again for being on the show today. It's been such a pleasure. I've wanted this for a while.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing you Thursday. Next week, my guest will be writer Terry Wolverton. I'm very excited about that. So join me next week, if you can, for another episode of Poetescape.